Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's program.
A landscape architect can tell us something about horticulture. The engineer is going to tell us something about what kind of structure is going to stand. But the designers alone make designs. They don't make places.
What makes a space into a place? And what makes it come alive? On this week's episode, we delve into the concept of placemaking as we explore a new book which tells the stories of community members responding to some of the daunting challenges in their cities. We also visit the Uruguayan city of Mercedes to see how a jazz festival is bringing music to its citizens and life to its streets. And we stroll beneath the railway arches in London, where a regeneration project is reigniting a quiet corner of the historic Borough Market. All that coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, we're going to start today in the world of placemaking. How Spaces Become Places is a recent book edited by John F. Forrester, a professor in the City and Regional Planning Department at Cornell University and a collector of practice-focused oral histories in the participatory planning world. Try saying that after a few drinks. The book is full of inspiring stories of grassroots planners bringing community ideas to their cities. And I'll let John explain more about what can be found on its pages.
We learn about community building in response to racial violence in Brooklyn, New York, and Azusa near Los Angeles, California. We see striking rituals of reclaiming place through community involvement in Providence's popular water fire festivals, and also in the cathartic burning of the stigma sculpture by community members taking back their park in Eagleby, Queensland. In Detroit, Michigan, and in Paris, France, too, urban gardeners of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and the Green Hand and Garden Seeds programs transform underused spaces into vibrant places. Nearby Manchester in the UK, an interfaith forum creates safer streets and community following anti-immigrants' violence. In Rochester, New York, steady community work creates pedestrian-friendly streets and an art walk, showcasing public art, museums, and open spaces alike. In Portland, Oregon, do-it-yourself urbanism produces vernacular intersection repairs on the Oregon coast. A planning consultant's jargon gets them fired, and then fresh community-oriented planners then work brilliantly. At the Minnesota-Wisconsin border, the St. Croix River, a 30-year war between highway engineers, preservationists, and environmentalists is successfully mediated. 28 stakeholders actually negotiate an acceptable design for a new bridge.
I spoke to John a little earlier to help get him to illustrate some of these case studies and explain more about this community-minded approach to city building. I started by asking how he defines this term, placemaking.
We can think about placemaking as the changes that we bring to a geometric space. We can have depth, breadth, height, whatever, but until that space is used in some way, it doesn't become a place. It's an abstract measurement. So it takes people to make places. We can have what looks like an underused space in a downtown, and if neighborhood people start gardening in it, it becomes a community garden. It's no longer an underused derelict space. If we've got a street in which cars are speeding by, neighbors may worry that their kids aren't safe. It's a space that is dangerous, and in that case, a place that is dangerous, somewhere you go and you're in danger. And so we see neighbors organizing to change spaces as given, underused with possibility, dangerous, promising. We see neighbors organizing to change those spaces into places they like to be, places they can use, places they enjoy.
So for you, the alliance that you need to come together to make a space into a place, as it were, it sounds like placemaking is something that can be done almost by anybody who has a community connection.
It's not only can be done almost by anybody, I mean, it is done almost by anybody. Then the question arises what it is that designers can bring. And so designers can bring an extra expertise to anticipate problems, to think about sight lines, to think about porosity of soil and all sorts of things. But Absolutely. It's community members and users and consumers and walkers and pedestrians that are going to make a space into a place. But the design expertise can help, of course. A landscape architect can tell us something about horticulture. An engineer is going to tell us something about what kind of structure is going to stand. But the designers alone make designs. They don't make places.
You give a huge number of amazing examples. Does that mean that you think that cities, authorities in a way, have learned to stand back and allow placemaking to happen, that they appreciate its value for a city these days?
Not at all. Authorities and professionals have an institutional arrogance to them, right? And part of the chapters in the book show the results of that arrogance with communities who come to distrust the intentions of outsiders, come to be befuddled by their language. So that in the wonderful case in Oregon, a community planner is walking around the community, says, well, we just fired the planners. They were using this fancy language of mixed use and things like that. We got rid of them. And they keep walking and guy points to a store down below and residence above. He says, now that's something we like. And so Zelinka says, well, you know, that could be called mixed use. That's fine. But if placemakers are professionals, they have to build trusted relationships of transparency and accountability with community members. If placemakers aren't professionals, they're usually community organizers of one sort or another, who then draw upon experts as needed for technical things. So you see urban agriculture in Detroit or community gardens in Paris. They're organized against the suspicions of what Laurent Baudelaire calls the patrimony of landscape architects. Traditional professionals can be presumptuous, can be arrogant, have been in many cases arrogant, but in other cases, there are some who really work well with diversity in multiple communities. And there you have democracy in action.
The very nature of this being community rooted at its best and, you know, often finding opportunities in overlooked spaces, does it mean that most of the projects tend to be of a smaller scale, probably not dependent on huge funds, a little bit spontaneous in places?
Most of the examples in my book are community-based, and so that would be true. The two exceptions that come to mind are the work of Barnaby Evans in Providence, who had the brilliant idea to take the Providence River running through downtown and put braziers of burning wood in the middle of the river, dedicated a night where there would be fires in the river and music playing, and people by the tens of thousands turned out and made this a celebration that was not going to be a one-off anymore. It became an institution. That's city scale. It ended up involving lots and lots of money and making lots and lots of money for Providence. The other example that comes to mind is the St. Croix River crossing between the states of Minnesota and Wisconsin that Mike Hughes mediated with 28 stakeholders. That certainly needed funding. It involved the participation of both states' departments of transportation, so big bucks, big agencies, but it was work on the ground to try to figure out what do we do about the law that says if there's going to be another bridge built, then some bridge has to come down. And he solved that problem with 28 stakeholders after having to tell the transportation engineers, look, you have been fighting with these people for 30 years. These people don't trust you to build a new bridge. So if you're not going to let us make a design, negotiate a design with you about the bridge, you're never going to get anything done. And that's what broke the business as usual. And so they ended up being able, with expertise and visualization and so on, to design a new bridge that then met the approval of the transportation engineers, who then went ahead and built the bridge.
And John, people hearing these incredible stories and thinking that actually there is an opportunity to do some placemaking where they live, what's your advice to people trying to think about organizing themselves to, you know, come out their front door and begin making this kind of change?
At one point in the book, I say, look, planners and designers don't work solo and they don't work in silos. And what that means is that the designers and the planners and placemakers are always working with other people who have place attachment, who care about these places. And then the first skill is the ability to bring people together, acknowledge the range of things that they care about in these places. And then with that acknowledgement and that openness to listening to the whole range of things that people might hope for, then take a next step in a process and say, well, what kinds of things might we do? Might we do soon? Might we do later? What kind of things would be more expensive, less expensive? What kind of expertise do we need? And then that group who says, this is a place we care about, here are some things we think we'd love to do, then that group can figure out who to invite in to listen to for expertise. And then they can sharpen ideas about what to do. Now, I had edited an earlier book called Planning in the Face of Conflict, which is the story of a dozen mediators of public disputes. And what you see in their work is really the answer to your question. And they don't have to be professional mediators, but the answer to your question being some trajectory over time that starts with, we care about this place. We can listen to each other's stories about our experiences here and what we want. And now we can learn about what kind of things we could do. And in order to learn about what we could do, we got to bring in some outside expertise. You have local knowledge and expert knowledge. And then you try to invent various solutions and make some choices. So it's definitely doable. It doesn't depend completely on university training and professionalism, but expertise helps, of course.
John F. Forrester, professor in the City and Regional Planning Department at Cornell University, thanks for joining me. Next, we head to Uruguay, to the city of Mercedes. Far from the country's busy capital of Montevideo, Mercedes might not be the first thought for tourists, but a festival dubbed Jazz Takes to the Streets has been bringing music to the locals and visitors to this lesser-known centre for years. Listen to Elliot went along to the festival and brought us this report.
Along the banks of the Rio Negro, where Uruguay almost touches Argentina, the unusual sound of jazz can be heard along the winding riverside promenade each January. The lesser-known city of Mercedes, roughly 200 miles west of the Uruguayan capital, hosts an annual music festival titled Jazz a la Calle, or Jazz Takes to the Streets. What started as a way to encourage music learning amongst youngsters has grown into a recognised cultural event that runs for roughly a fortnight at the height of summer, with musicians from Colombia, Ecuador and parts of Europe travelling to play along the cobblestone avenues, in squares and outside homes. For Uruguayans, it's an example of how the arts can be successfully moved away from the country's traditional urban centres, and that with a little imagination, adapt public space with surprising benefits. President and founder Horacio Acosta, who goes by Macoco, sat down with me during the sound check inside the city's immaculate Art Deco style theatre. The heavy summer rains had come, and the main evening event had to be moved indoors, an exception for the outdoor festival.
Bueno, ya están escuchando la comparsita, por ejemplo. Este movimiento es un movimiento que nace en el año 2006.
The movement began back in 2006 with a group of neighbors, artists and locals from Mercedes. I was actually living in Montevideo back then, and we all felt a notable decline in music learning. I think it's a global trend. With the arrival of new technology, be that MP3s or other devices, it has created a confusion around the difference between the active music experience and the passive, listening versus performing. And many people have abandoned the study of music that contributes to our intellectual development. So if fewer people take part in that activity, the collective intellect of that community declines. And this was something we felt was very serious.
With that in mind, they set up monthly workshops and a music school that offers classes to students from as young as four right the way through to a high school diploma, while inviting different musicians, both amateurs and professionals, to come together at the start of the new year. All shows and jams are free. Horacio explained that the title of the festival, Jazz a la Calle, does not mean that the main idea is to encourage street performances. Instead, the term refers to bringing music closer to people, to those who occupy the city streets and inhabit its low-lying houses.
Hay una idea que puede resultar confusa.
it can be confusing. Just because it's called Jazz Takes to the Street does not mean we want musicians to play in the street. During the event, there are just so many musicians that inevitably they spill out and find corners of the city to perform and socialize with the public. But the phrase is really a nod to the way jazz musicians think. It's an open mind, empathetic, profound, and the way they can connect to the average man on the street. So if we encourage them to share not just the music, but their way of thinking with others, we'll build a better society. That's the main objective behind what we're doing.
That connection is evident as you wander around. There's a real atmosphere as the rain clouds cleared and the summer nights set in. Elderly ladies with their beach chairs set themselves up waiting for a saxophonist to begin outside their bungalow. Groups of teenagers gathered by the waterfront where a new local act was set to perform. And tourists from other corners of Uruguay joined an improv session over a picnic with their dogs in the square.
It is a very intense, exceptional connection with the local community and the audience too. This is something that for me is very difficult to explain or capture in a photo. The feeling that the music generates and makes people of the city feel. I can say that in all the years of running the festival, where sometimes we have 1,000 people taking part one way or another, we've never had any altercations with the police or incidents of crime. Sometimes people have felt unwell due to the high temperatures at this time of the year, but no one has ever been violent. Never has it become rowdy. This is what a photo doesn't show. It's a fairly calm city. Uruguay in general is that way. Things are controlled, but we don't escape the issues of delinquency and crime. But I really think our festival has an impact and has changed behavior. Notably, what we've seen is better attendance in schools. Parents have noticed children who have formal music training and aspire to be in the festival are also tending to be more dedicated when it comes to their schoolwork and other aspects of their lives. Music education requires discipline, and if they don't have the discipline, they don't play. Music is very cruel in that way. Before, people didn't really get what we were doing here. Now they understand why we set up the school, the festival, and they share it with their families.
Musicians like Lionel, who traveled for a holiday, but in the way the jazz improvisation goes, ended up taking center stage as part of a newly formed band that evening, agreed that there was something very special about the use of the physical space in Mercedes.
I like what happens here. There are very few places in the world that are special. There are a lot of places and a lot of people, and this is one of them. It's also the organizers who run the festival, the sense of communion, of coming together, emotion. It's contagious, united by a love and respect for the music, of course, but also to do with how the space is used.
The month of January tended to be a time when the city felt fairly deserted. Sweltering temperatures, often surpassing 40 degrees centigrade, together with the custom of heading to the popular beach resorts towards the east, meant few residents stayed in Mercedes. Today it's become a place to visit in its own right, in part because the organisers encouraged locals to rent rooms early on to passing musicians, cementing a new bond. Businesses soon caught on. Several hotels, boat charters and restaurants have opened since. This year, despite the arrival of Omicron, the agenda is packed, with roughly 180 formal acts. Early workshops kick off at 9 a.m. From there, musicians go into town and sign up to join different spontaneous ensembles that start performing at dusk. The main act then follows, and the music continues along the cul-de-sacs till dawn. Local pianist Martin said that you need stamina.
After the show, the jam starts at Manzana 20. Every day there's a different theme. A Brazilian jam, Charlie Parker. Each night there's a different group that plays two or three pieces. And that runs through until 3 a.m. And from there, we move inside and carry on. I think the only limit is the heat of the sun.
For Monocle 24, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
Borough Market in London's Southwark has been a lively destination for produce for centuries. but a newly redeveloped square and railway arch complex next to it will increase footfall further in 2022. Borough Yards is a gleaming new brick-built space with room for 50 new shops and restaurants, plus 17,000 square metres of fresh office space, all a stone's throw from the popular Victorian Market Hall and the neat independent shops that line it. The soft opening of the newly scrubbed-up Soap Yard space welcomed visitors in December, and the rest of the development by London-based architect Spark will open fully in spring 2022, including a range of top-notch restaurants from Barrafina, Vinateca and more, all to be announced soon. Well, Monocle's Josh Fennett met Marcus Mayor, CEO of developer Mark. He asked about the project and why Mayor is still sanguine about the future of living, shopping, meeting and eating in city centres, despite what's been quite a few bumpy years.
We're sitting in Borough Yards now, and as I look out of the window in front of me, I can see a site that has been the same maybe for 100 years. I can see the borough market in front of us, the fresh produce, the people buying and selling. But then you pass through a little alleyway and there's a new world. Tell us about this development.
So essentially we brought back to life, you know, a very vibrant space from the Middle Ages that over the last decades under the railway tracks basically became a sort of a no-go area for people, but right next to Borough Market. And so we decided to reopen it up again to the public, for people to work, for people to have food, to have dinner, to have entertainment, and basically recreating the original streetscape.
And I was here about a week ago, and the gate to this area underneath the arch was shut. But when people walk through it, give us a sense of the scale of this development that you've taken on and what it takes in. As I look out, I see an everyman cinema, I can see office spaces, but how, you know, how big is this kind of undiscovered area in quite a discovered part of London?
I mean, the area is very large, not only I think in terms of floor area. So I think we're, you know, we have roughly 70,000 square feet of office space, 70,000 square feet of F&B retail space. But it's also the volumes, because these railway arches, you know, they're all somewhere between 9 and 11 meters tall. So they're very voluminous spaces, which I think changes the perception for people as well.
What people won't get, in a sense, from the audio is the amazing materials that have been used here, some of which have been kept from the old railway arches, from Thames House, this building in front of us. You know, there's amazing texture over time of these kind of Victorian edifices. But there's some new bits as well. How did you manage that kind of dance between the old and the new and keeping that sense of authenticity and in the medieval streetscape, as you say?
The biggest challenge, I think, was choosing the right brick. So obviously there was a lot of existing brick already in Thames House, which was very historical, which we restored. But then we also had to bring the new brick in, which had to really, really match that historical brick. And I think our architect, Spark, based in London and have done a lot of very impressive projects, they nailed it exactly with the bricks, not only with the exact right materiality and color of the bricks, but also the way they've played around with the texture.
And as a developer, I need to ask you a little bit about the bottom line. We've had a turbulent few months as we conduct this interview. There's some uncertainty about rule changes in London to do with hospitality. And hasn't it been a torrid time for retail as well? You know, how do you feel embarking on the soft opening of certain parts of this project? What's the confidence like from the tenants and from you as the developer?
So I think retail, you know, more than ever is a long-term play. It's not something where you can build something, you know, maximize the rents and then try to make a profit. So I think everything takes time to kind of mature. And this scheme post-COVID, you know, will probably take at least 12 to 18 months to fully lease up and to reach a level of stability where I think you've got customers coming in, where retailers are starting to do a good trade, where F&B operators are starting to make good money. And, you know, it will probably take 3 to 4 years for this scheme to come to full stabilization. And obviously, inevitably, in every scheme, in every retail scheme, you'll have retailers that, at the end of the day, don't make it. Those initial years of stabilization will determine who will be here to stay and also who we can bring as a potentially better tenant to come in, as other ones maybe fall by the wayside.
And when we looked through, I saw a big mix of units. There are some extremely large ones and some extremely small ones. What was the thinking behind that? Is there kind of an incentive to give smaller businesses a bit of a leg up there, or is it just about giving people a range of options?
I think a bit of both. I mean, the big railway arches, obviously, they're so large in terms of floor to ceiling height, in terms of width, that it's difficult to cut them up into smaller spaces. So our bigger spaces are definitely concentrated in those arches. And therefore, we had to create, for instance, that arcade that you saw earlier on, which has a lot of small units, which really caters to smaller independent retailers, let's say. But you could think of a flower shop, a bakery, for example, a candle shop. Things that maybe in your perception could have been here already when this was originally existing in the 16th century.
Whenever I walk through borough markets just across the way, I'm always struck and a little bit inspired by the nice range of niche businesses. They're honest, they're independent, they're small often. Some of them started here and then grew into restaurant chains that went around London. How are you thinking about getting that mix right? And have you said no to anyone yet?
Well, we had a lot of demand for the F&B units, so for the restaurant units. And so we had to say no to some people because we had, three, four offers for each unit. So there it was really a selection of who we felt was the best fit for this area right next to Borough Market, and also in the context of some of the other restaurants that we'd already selected. I think one of the very positive things about all of the challenging changes in retail is that the balance sheet, let's say the creditworthiness of the retailer, is probably less important than it ever was. And it's more important what the concept of the retailer is and what they bring to the table and how they add to the mix. And so I think that's a really good thing because it means you don't focus as much as people used to do on getting a very big brand with as many outlets as possible in your new space. But you ideally want to go for that independent retailer, like you said. And even if that retailer has a very small number or only one unit, that might actually be a better value add for your space than somebody with, a significant number of outlets across the UK.
And as we sit in the kind of light-bathed, fully windowed kind of showroom at the front, I can see a trickle of people finding their way already through the yards. They're being kind of drawn inexorably by that, maybe a little bit of a sense of curiosity about a new space opening up. How important is it to you that this area also connects people, that it's also a thoroughfare? And how important is that to the experience? Because I think a lot of us have got used to the idea of malls, I've been in the UAE recently, go up to floor 8 for this. This is all ground level. It is all in the fresh air, in the sometimes inclement British weather at times. How do you feel about this kind of layout? And is there a future for this, maybe compared to a big shiny glass and steel number?
I mean, I think people want authenticity in everything. And it goes with the whole trend towards sustainability and recycling and reuse and all those kinds of things. And I think just like secondhand sales of luxury goods are booming like crazy because people don't feel like it makes sense to buy the new product all the time at full price and all the production issues that are associated with it. I think it's the same with retail and leisure and F&B. I think being in an authentic space that's already existed, I think people genuinely feel, they feel more authenticity, and so that's where they want to be. I think the other thing that Borough Yard specifically offers is sort of an oasis of calm in a really busy, bustling area. So if you walk through Borough Market, it's really difficult to find a quiet corner. I mean, unless you go into a restaurant and you sit somewhere in the back. But other than that, it's basically standing shoulder to shoulder with people everywhere. And I think part of the reason why people wander in here as well is because it kind of feels like that oasis of calm, and it's obviously, very attractive to look at compared to, all of the chaos that's around it. And I think that that's another reason for people to come in here.
And I've been lucky to have a sneak peek and to be shown around by you and have the benefit of your experience seeing the site develop and evolve since you acquired it in 2016. But when can the rest of the world begin to see it, and what's the kind of opening up plan?
So all of the F&B operators and some of the retailers that basically secured their spaces are doing their fit outs. The first ones will open somewhere around February, March. So I think by the time there's sort of a more significant number that will open and it will really start to feel alive is probably around April next year.
That was Monocle's Josh Fennett speaking to Marcus Mayor, CEO of Mark, the developer behind the Borough Yards development in London's Southwark. And it's going to all fully open in spring 2022. And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to get your weekly dose of urbanism every Thursday, as well as our sister show, Tall Stories, with new episodes released every Monday. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the programme. And to play you out of this week, well, here's Nick Drake with Place to Be. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Now I'm darker.
just hand me down.